Davros. I should have known. I see you've discarded the last vestige of your human form. It's still no improvement.
Save your insults for the weak-minded doctor.
Will you return the Hand of Omega or not?
Are you threatening me? If so, it is most unwise.
Every time our paths have crossed, I have defeated you.
And coming up in episode 3, we have a new section. It's the Mind Probe.
Four.
And in the Time Lash, it's Davros. Good, bad, or just fucking ugly.
All three.
All this and more
in Doctor Who, The Complete Menagerie.
Almost.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Doctor Who, The Complete Menagerie, a podcast dedicated to Doctor Who. That's Tom.
Hello, that's me, hello.
This is Greg.
Hello.
And this is Buddy Windruff.
What? An imposter! An imposter!
Well, hello.
My name's Sam, by the way.
Sam, what's going on? Who's this small chap sitting on his child's chair by the side of the side of the table here?
What does he want?
When we were recording, we were into Hanky Panky.
We were. Yeah.
Full thrust.
We were. Yes.
And there was a knock at the door. Greg answered, and yes. Buddy Windruff was there.
It was a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Some Johnny Come Lately.
Ah.
Knocking down the door.
Was it the possibility of you winning the prize which Greg seeded at the end of series one? What was that, Greg?
The prize was a copy of The Nth Doctor by our favourite Frenchman. It's Jean-Marc Le Officier!
Come to my Doctor Who Daddies. See what you like. Amarotter? The cloister bed?
Tom's Elaspas.
So, yes, he's a Frenchman, and this book was so good that we thought we'd give it away. No one wanted it cluttering up their shelves.
No, so...
Buddy Windrush.
Buddy Windrush, you've won our star prize! And
I don't want it. It's too. It looks very well thumbed, I have to say.
Well, it's, yeah...
Second hand, even when I got my hands on it.
A bit of a bent spine. A bit like Nicola Bryant.
how did Buddy Windrush win this esteemed
prize? Yes, tell. Yes.
The question was, how did we meet? And we wanted to know, in a fictional way, how the menagerie met. And Buddy Windrush, your winning answer was...
I said you may have met in a Turkish bath in King's Cross.
Which is fictionally inaccurate, but a bloody good story. We like that. Yes. So, Buddy Windrush, here is your Nth Doctor... paperback, yeah.
I'm overwhelmed.
Yes. Now, of course, Buddy Windrush isn't your real name.
No, it's not.
That's the name of Brian Moseley.
Brian Moseley's stuntman alter ego, yes.
Ah.
Right. Yeah.
He was credited in Doctor Who.
In the Dalek Master Plan, yes.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, you're not just a Doctor Who fan, you also play drums.
I do play drums, yeah. Part-time in Red Light Revival.
Red Light
Leeds Rock and Roll Band.
What's the Twitter handle?
Red Light Revival, I think.
At Red Light Revival.
Yeah,
I'd follow them on Twitter.
They're doing very, very well, very good.
Buy their cassette.
A couple of albums out.
Cassettes.
Yes.
Well, the third EP is coming out very soon.
Excellent. Well, you can see the reviews of the first two on Entertainment Focus.
Three episodes of all that bloody entertainment.
Plugs are us.
Yes. Tom is just leaning back in his chair with shit coming out of his eyes.
This podcast is taking a downward turn. Anyway,
we're so commercial.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's lovely to have you in the cab.
It's nice to be here, Mr. Pertwee.
Yeah, it's very nice.
So, could you give us some of your impressions? Because you've given us some in the past, and it'd be a shame not to hear them, I think. So, number one.
Well, Tom is my number one. Ah,
oh, he like me.
Well, yes, we're my number two. I'd like to say it's very nice to be here amongst you stalwarts. I'd say that the Complete Menagerie, you are a bunch of craven-hearted poltroons. And sometimes you're stiff and sometimes you're bendy.
And have you ever ordered in an Indian restaurant?
Well, yes, I was, I think it was after a recording of Revenge of the Mysterons. I was sitting down with darling Michael Wisher, Mickey, and he passed me the menu, and I said, well, Mike, I don't know, do I have the rice? I don't know what his response was, nothing complimentary, but...
He was wearing a paper bag on his head at the time, wasn't he?
Smoking for it.
Yes. I remember that one, it was called Scardo.
Yes, I get on cassette.
Don't you remember the story? I remember the name of the pub was called the Fleur de Lis.
Well, yes, I think you're the best impressionist of us all, really, in terms of Tom
very
Baker.
Good, very good.
There are better ones. Do you do another impression? Do you have other impressions?
Well, what about that boy who salvaged the Daleks for us, without whom we would not have the Daleks?
Well, are we allowed to do that one?
Evil Annie.
Evil Annie.
As J&T used to call him.
Yes, can we do Evil Annie?
I think we can do one.
We can do Evil Annie.
I hate him. I hate him. I used to go around every weekend. I'd bin the pies. And I'd say, pull them all. Blow it out your ass. He wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have it. And that Phil Morris, what a cunt.
Oh, very good.
Excellent.
It's been lovely to have you on the show, buddy.
Yeah. Buddy Windrush does a one-man Dominators installment. The whole of the Dominators. One-man show.
What, only when I'm drunk.
You can't squeeze one out now.
I can if you like. Toba, how many more times do I have to tell you? We've gone through this 1,000 times. We get the fuel sorted first, then we start the dominating. Please, pretty please, with sugar on top. Go and get the fucking fuel. And then, of course, I said, okay, Toba, one more time. This quark is very small. That quark is far away.
There isn't a fourth impression, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, very lovely. Yeah. So, as our competition winner, you are now in a fix with Suntara,
with flying colours.
How's about a menagerie with four people in it?
It's almost complete. How does it feel to be on the podcast after being such a keen listener?
Yeah. Well, I've been gunning for it for months. So yeah.
None's against it. World will stop me now.
Dream come true, isn't it?
It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, buddy. As our official advisor in an Evil Annie capacity.
It's been a delight to be here. I hope
you'll be able to find our missing episodes for us.
I'll do my very best. We'll report back in 2 decades, probably.
Yes.
Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Well, you can stick around. Would you like a pickled egg?
Oh, I can see them across the desk. Yes, I wouldn't mind.
Would you like to crack them open
like
now?
A pickled egg?
Crack them open now. And while you're doing that,
pickled egg segment.
Pickled egg. Tom can seed his line while you're serving the egg.
As you're serving the egg. I've never had one, and this is going to be a rather exciting pickled egg odyssey. But before we have that, guess the line. This isn't for Buddy Windrush because he knows every line in every show. You can give me your best shot. An unintelligent enemy is far less dangerous than an intelligent one. Just act stupid. You know this, Buddy Windrush, I know from the look on your face. An unintelligent enemy is far less dangerous than an intelligent one. Just act stupid. Any ideas?
Sounds like Patrick Troughton.
Oh, you may be right. Well, you are right.
Ah, oh, it does sound like Patrick Troughton. Is it the Dominator?
It is! Yay!
Sorted.
What a marvellous topical thing.
There we go.
So we're now going to try Greg's eggs. This is a great radio.
I have to cut it down.
I can smash the whole thing.
Tom, you
share a plate with me.
You've never had a pickled egg before.
I've never had a pickled egg. I'm a big fan of the egg in many ways. It's an ovoid delight. That's the sound of salt being.
I think that's absolutely essential for a pickled egg.
It does smell like an old man's nadgers. So that's always a good thing.
Bolivian unicyclist.
This is the salt being shaken there. There we go. So we put a bit of salt. Is this salt selling work?
It's coming out.
Yes, it is.
I'm astonished that a pub enthusiast like Tom Bailey has
never had a
pickled egg.
So, after three, here goes.
Really nice.
Good. Mm. They're homemade. They're
very mild, actually.
They've been brewing for about 2 months.
Vile.
You're not a fan, Tom.
No.
Tom's face.
That's very good.
Wow.
On Corey.
Oh,
No, I'm to quote John Martin Fisher.
I've never had anything so bad in my... I'll stick to pickled onions, I think.
That's splendid. Mm. Oh, pass it over, Tom.
That'll be, there, you
waste not, want not.
I've had a quarter of my ovoid delight, but I think that'll be repeating on me for the rest of the podcast, to be honest. So, well, thanks for that experience. But
you're welcome.
Well done, beginning the line. Mm.
So this is episode 3 of our second season. Thanks for staying with us.
Do you want to cut there? And what are we going to do with him?
He can stay if he wants.
Well,
it's up to him.
I'll hang around. I won't intrude too much.
Interject.
So this is episode 3 of our second season. Thanks for staying with us. It's called Terry Nation's Davros Special because it's a Davros special. And quite simply because Davros made a return to our screens. He was in the media in the new television series of Doctor Who. Now,
I can sense the excitement in your voice there, Sam.
We're not going to talk about that. It's not the remit of our show. But we are going to talk about, is Davros in the original series and what sort of effect he had? Before we do that, we've got a new segment.
Oh, I love a new segment.
And it's called The Mind Probe.
Ooh, I like a good probe.
So, without any further ado, let's go into The Mind Probe.
Let's do it.
You are authorized to use the Mind Probe.
What?
The Mind Probe.
No, not the Mind Probe.
Welcome to BT Answer 1571. The person you're calling is not available. Please leave a message after the tone.
Hello?
Hello, Sam. It's Terry.
Oh, hello, Terry. I thought I got the wrong number then. I was just about to try dialing again. You okay?
No, I'm fine now. I was on the loo. As one is, you know. Old people, we spend most of our time staggering from one dinner frame to the loo and back again.
Well, I've actually got a list of questions for you, Terry.
Okay.
Dry roasted or salted?
Sometimes salted, sometimes roasted. Mostly salted.
Mostly salted?
Mostly salted, yeah.
Dogs or cats?
Both, but I've got dogs at the moment. But I've had lovely cats too.
Cameron or Corbyn?
Corbyn! How dare you say that other word?
Do you have an opinion on pickled eggs?
Don't like them.
Don't like them?
Nope.
Here's one that's had people scratching their heads. Is that you in the new Fruit Pastels advert?
Yes.
It is you?
It is me, yeah. So it was an ident for Radio 4 Films, you know, Film 4, you know, where they have these idents. And, I play, there's a couple of characters I play there. One is a sort of a kind of Game of Thrones sort of guy. And it's to do with divas, you know. So you're in your dressing room and the butler brings in this plate of pastels, which is made to represent my face. You know, I'm doing this sort of, oh, yes, lovely, thank you. Oh, delicious. And the same as Caesar as well. Another one was Caesar, where the guy brings in the pastel and dusts it and then passes it to me before I put it in my mouth. You know?
Right.
Yeah, very silly.
I thought that was a red herring question.
The real question, yes, it is me.
So here's a more traditional one for you, Terry. How did you get into acting?
How did I get into acting? By being a lazy bastard, basically. By studying music and drama at Liverpool. And, you know, almost going into the music business, but realising I was so lazy, I'd have to work really hard to be as good a musician as I'd want to be. And acting was much easier and there were more days off.
But probably a lot harder now these days for an actor.
My God, yes. Now, you know, I mean, I have great empathy and respect for the actors that try to do it now because they haven't do it themselves. Mm. You know, and as I say to them, you know, people say, well, how do you get started at all? In my day, it was very, very different. But now, I mean, if you want to do it, you've got to do it yourself. You've got to write it, produce it, you've got to cast it, you've got to find the finance for it, you've got to find a venue to put it on, you've got to juggle all the balls. You know, you can't wait and sit and wait for the phone to ring because it won't. You've got to be the driving force in your own career.
I've been looking at your career, actually, and it seems to be that an awful lot of links seem to stem from a show called Radio Phoenix. Radio Phoenix. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, there's... yes. And also, I mean, I seem to have spent my career taking over from other people. I mean, in fact, a director said to me once, It was kind of a backhanded compliment, I suppose. He said, "You know, Terry, you're the last person I think of when I'm casting." I said, "Oh, thank you." He said, "But you're the first person I think of when I'm in the shit, because I know you'll be able to pull the goods, require somebody who needs replacing, whatever it may be." You know, I mean, I've replaced Nicolas Cage in Birmingham Rep's production of Measure for Measure. I've come in, I replaced Mike Tucker, for God's sake. You know, he was played by Gareth Armstrong for about 3 or 4 episodes, and then he went off to join the Radio Rep, so they had to replace him. And I replaced Gareth by, you know, sounding like him.
Were you considered to be a good mimic of other people's style?
Yes, yeah, I think so. I've always had an ability with voices from when I was a kid, memorising the Goon Show.
Greetings, my loyal subjects, and all
of... My mum worked for the Aiding Forces Broadcasting Association, and they would send out the transcription discs from England of the new episodes, and I would be in the station when they were, you know, trying them out, make sure they were okay. And I would memorise the entire thing while they were playing it, you know, and I'd do all the voices. I'd always had that facility, for mimicking accents, dialects, you know, sometimes people. So, yeah, I suppose there is that. And, yeah, as you say, Radio Phoenix, that was directed by Matthew Robinson. And Matthew Robinson then went on, purely by chance, to take over Resurrection of the Daleks, which it wasn't his show. I mean, that had happened as a result of a BBC strike that had moved everything backwards a month. By the time that happened, the director who was meant to be directing Resurrection was on something else. Michael Wisher had gone off to Australia on a tour, and Matthew took over. I thought, right, who do I know that could take this on? And just rang me up and said, "Do you want to do this?"
That must have been quite an interesting offer for you. Did you think anything of it at the time, or did it just feel like another job?
Partly another job, but a really interesting job. Sitting and watching Genesis, you know, because I didn't know anything about Davros. He said, "Well, sit and watch the tapes," you know, because I stopped watching Doctor Who after Troughton, when I, you know, went off and, you know, went to university and other things happened.
Sure.
I just kind of lost track of it, really. So I missed basically most of, I mean, I saw the odd episode of Pertwee and Baker, but not really enough to, you know, clocked who Davros was for a start.
Well, not many actors are in on a Saturday night, are they?
No, this is true. You're either on stage or you're out getting pissed drunk and bemoaning the state of the business, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, what I realised was that the character really, this is why I was intrigued and interested in doing it, that it was almost like doing a radio play on camera, because the character had to come from the voice.
"You hesitate, Doctor. If I were you, I would be dead."
"I lack your practice, Davros."
"You are soft, like all Time Lords. You prefer to stand and watch. Action requires courage. Something you lack."
The mask was virtually immobile. You know, it produced a image, but it wasn't a movable image without a vast amount of work from the actor inside the mask to get the slightest bit of movement on the outside. The days of the prosthetics they've got today is a whole, you know, whole new ball game, really. Yeah, that intrigued me that we were going to have to create the character from the voice. And I listened to what Michael had done, and then I was looking at how he'd achieved that, and, you know, using the script to get that timbre, that sort of depth of psychosis into the character as you're playing it. And it was only when I actually got the mask on I realised how much the mask informs how you deliver that, because you're having to fight through the mask. And it is really like a battle to get through the mask, and very claustrophobic, and it makes you, the strictures of the mask make you have to speak in a very particular enunciated way in order to get the words through it. So you automatically got that staccato delivery that Musha had, you know, and you just bring in the psychosis and you know, before long, Davros appears, you know. So it was a fascinating exercise, but I really did think it was just a job, the one for 2 weeks. Here we are, 30-plus years later.
It's a real legacy now, isn't it? I mean, it's going to be something that people never forget. You're stuck with it for good and for bad.
I'm delighted to be stuck with it. It's rather nice, you know. It's good to enjoy sharing with people what I enjoyed of doing it and how they enjoyed what I did doing it. either on telly or later with Big Finish.
So you were saying earlier about the technical constrictions of being in the costume and everything else, and that's somehow actually affecting how you behaved as soon as you got into that costume. And
yeah.
That seems to be a link with an awful lot of horror and masked actors, traditionally. I've noticed that. Do you think, particularly with the character of Davros, because his senses are very diminished, his eyesight, and presumably yours was as well,
yeah,
when you're in the costume, that affected how you interacted with your fellow actors as well, that you were somehow separated from them in how you performed?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it was interesting how, you know, rehearsing with people and getting on really, really well, as soon as you get in the costume, makeup people ignore you or don't really want to interact because suddenly you become something different.
It's fascinating that, because I was reading in a book, the Graham Harper Classics book, and they were interviewing a number of the cast from Revelation of the Daleks. One of the actors says, "Oh, and I spoke to Terry Molloy on the corridor, and he happens to be such a nice, affable fellow." The assumption being that you wouldn't be.
No, quite.
Because you're playing a dark character who actually looks quite repulsive. It's strange, isn't it?
It is. People have this idea. But then, actually, when you talk to a lot of actors who play, you know, ghastly characters, you find that actually they're really rather nice. A lot of them I've met that have played monsters, you know, they're really jolly people, you know. And, you know, it's whether it's something we get our own demons out of ourselves by playing monsters, you know, to scare people in television. It means we can be really quite nice occasionally, you know, although I am noted for being a grumpy old man. Well, I'm old enough to officially be a grumpy old man. And why not? You know, they have actually recreated restored my original chair. And Mike Tucker found the original head mould, my original head mould from 83, 82, and the original mask mould that was created for it in a cupboard somewhere.
An incredible find. I saw the pictures.
And they've done, you know, managed to get 6 pulls from it before it started to really disintegrate. I mean, the head is fine, but the actual mask mould, you know.
Yeah.
They would have to mould again to get it, you know. But they've managed to redo my original chariot and my original costume, which is now in the Cardiff exhibition, along with the original Emperor Dalek, again with another of my head masks in that one, at Cardiff as well, you know.
That's great. And it's nice they kept it in its last form as well, as it should be. That's great.
But, I mean, they found all this stuff, you know, hiding away in corners covered in cobwebs and about to be chucked out, you know, and they basically resurrected and restored it all. And it's a delight to know that they bring that era of Davros, the 80s era of Daleks and Davros, into the Cardiff thing.
Absolutely. Matthew Robinson was kind to you, wasn't he, because he asked you back on Doctor Who without the mask on.
He did, yeah, very much so.
Next year.
He rang me up the next year and said, "Do you want to do Who again, but as a, you know, as a person?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And so they got me in as Russell, this undercover cop.
There we are, gentlemen. Inside that building is £10 million in diamonds.
Tasty. Very tasty.
How long will you need?
About half an hour.
I'll send these two back with a car.
There's no need, I'll get a cab.
I said, Russell, I'll send the car for you.
Right.
Don't look so hurt. We're not going back to the flat, we're doing the job today.
I don't believe, apparently, I was originally being put up for the part of Payne.
Ah.
I looked to be alongside Brian Glover. But I don't know, the way they jig things around, and they eventually decided that I would do Russell. It was a delight and lovely to meet Colin at that point, you know, when he just started, really.
Fresh in the part, effectively, wasn't he, at that point? Fresh in the role.
Yeah, absolutely. And because that gave us a working relationship for later on when we did Revelation, you know.
Of course, because you opened and closed the season with him.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Started with Cyberman and ended with Revelation, yeah.
And you worked with Maurice Colburn on that, who was very high profile at the time, wasn't he?
Well, Maurice was on in Resurrection, and, I mean, a lovelier man you couldn't wish to meet. You know, I mean, I remember Maurice from the days of Gangsters in Birmingham that Philip Martin wrote and Mike Rolfe directed some of, you know. And this tough guy that he put over, you know, in that, and that he put it over in Who is, you know, again, he was this lovely soft giant who'd go off fishing when everybody was at breaking rehearsals. I mean, slightly different, obviously, in Howard's way, but I mean, yeah, lovely man. And so I obviously worked with him first on Resurrection and then again with Cyberman, Tekken Cyberman.
And then the same year, you're in Revelation of the Daleks again with Colin.
Yeah.
Arguably, probably in the best Davros script that you ever worked in.
It was brilliant. It really was good. I mean, it's my favourite of the three telly ones. Because it was actually very much a Davros story rather than a Doctor story. It was, you know, I mean, the Doctor fumbled around, had polystyrene, you know, stones drop on him, came in and mocked up at the end. You know, while all the rest of the cast are having this amazing time. And such a cast! Eleanor Bron and Clive Swift and Lexi Sale, Jenny Thomas. I mean, you know, it just went on and on. And it was that era when people really wanted to be in Doctor Who. You know, they were getting, you know, stellar people in. So I had these great people to work against. And obviously with Graham Harper directing it, it just had so much pizzazz. And, you know, Eric had done a fantastic job with the script, and this gothic set that they managed to construct in the studio gave it an intense darkness, which was delicious. It really was.
He certainly did marginalise Colin in that, for whatever reason. I think he was more interested in writing characters that he created himself, and especially Davros, for whatever reason. And it is a very odd story.
It is.
We reviewed it in our last season, and we love it, but it's barely a Doctor Who story. It could almost be a spin-off.
Yeah.
And be one of, like, an isolated Davros bubble story. And the Doctor doesn't really need to be in it at all, because he only arrives, as you say, at the very end, once everything's been dealt with.
Yeah.
It really showcases your part in that show.
It also gave us an opportunity to move forward, because, I mean, out in Resurrection, I was kind of regurgitating Michael Wisher, because that's what they wanted to bring back, but obviously with a bit of bite to it. So we still had the same kind of intergalactic Hitler feel to it. And the rants and all of that, whereas in Revelation, although they were there, there was slightly more subtlety and, you know, a little black humour, you know, when we mentioned dead bodies and, you know, the Doctor says, you mean you didn't tell people you were, you know, turning their relatives into food? And Davros says, certainly not. That would have created what I believe is termed consumer resistance.
I never waste a valuable commodity. The humanoid form makes an excellent concentrated protein. This part of the galaxy is developing quickly. Famine was one of its major problems.
You turn them into food?
A scheme that has earned me great acclaim!
But did you bother to tell anyone they might be eating their own relatives?
Certainly not! What I believe is termed consumer resistance. They were grateful for the food. It allowed them to go on living.
Until you take over their planet.
Precisely.
It's just little black moments in there. You think, yeah, okay, it's not just all madness. It's, it was like the beginning of a chess game between the Doctor and Davros, which I feel is the key to the relationship. It's not the bangs and the whistles and the Daleks blowing things up. It's actually their ability to recognise that they themselves are of an intellectual equal level and that they're both alone. And in a sense, they need each other, but they're both playing this intellectual chess game of who can push the other one over the edge all the time, or who can gain the upper hand. And that's where I felt it had had the ability to have the beginnings of a hook, which has been explored much more deeply in some of the Big Finish stuff, and indeed in the latest new series one.
Of course, yes. Well, they really extended it. It is a relationship now,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, it should have been. And you know, I was delighted to see that they put that, or he put that effort into exploring that relationship, head-to-head relationship, and the backstory, which could have ramifications, you know. And where did Davros come from? You know, we haven't seen that still yet. We know that he wasn't as he is right at the beginning. So something happened along the way, whether eventually they'll site to show that, as we did with I, Davros and a bit with Terra Firma. I don't know.
But that was the thing I was going to ask you, actually, during the television years.
Yeah.
Did you construct a backstory in your mind as to how he got to that point and why he behaved the way he did?
I was aware of how he behaved, and I didn't construct a full backstory, but I was beginning to understand some of the psychological essences of his personality, which were nature rather than nurture, that enabled him to be as callously cold as he was, and yet still had this belief that what he was doing was right. And that we took forward into I, Davros, when we were talking about it. I mean, my take on it is that, you know, you're, in a sense, looking at someone who's on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, you know, with an element of Asperger's in there, you know, that a brilliant savant mind, but a total inability to interact socially, and someone who only sees the problem and sees the answer to it, and whatever stands in the way of getting that answer to solve the problem is immaterial. You trample them underfoot in order to get the problem solved.
I am Davros. I am your creator. Without me, you have no function, no reason to exist. Without me, you are nothing. Where are the Daleks? Where are the supreme beings?
In the universe, yes, I know. I made you that way. I made you in my image.
Why?
A question. A Dalek asking a question. Just how far have you sunk into inferiority since my enforced separation from you all?
Answer the question!
Why did I make you in my image, or why did I make you at all? You exist because of the war. You exist because we needed to prove our superiority, and we did prove it, finally, absolutely. You are here as proof. The children of Davros! Children! As I was a child. Once.
His focus is on the end result, but whatever comes in the way is just going to be taken out in order to get to where he wants to go. So, I mean, those are the beginning thoughts that were, I suppose, partly in my mind when we were doing Resurrection and again with Remembrance, you know, and then taking that through into the big finish stuff where we had much more room to breathe those kind of things within the stories that came through, which were great. Because obviously, the telestory, you're restricted to all sorts of other things, you know, unless, of course, as they've done recently, pushing the one story into just that relationship between the two of them.
I mean, I think with radio, naturally, there's just going to be more talking, and that's going to be a more cerebral experience, isn't it? I mean, my view on the new Doctor Who series is simple. They try and do these set pieces of conversation and character development, which is always good, but they always feel they have to round it off with a James Bond explosion, which undercuts that, I feel. Yeah, sometimes it's a shame.
There should be just that moment of, obviously, I mean, in using the radio, you are painting the picture, you are creating that moment, you're creating that scenario, you're creating the atmosphere of the place you're in for the audience to pick up on. And for me, that's a delight more than television ever has been, is in creating those specific visual moments in the mind of the listener.
So you feel that the audio Doctor Who's stand up to the original TV series, but in a very different way?
Yes, very much so. They've extended them, they've allowed the Doctors, you know, certainly Colin's Doctor, to show what he is, to show something more of what he is. Paul's Doctor to, you know, encompass the things he might have done on telly, you know, and Peter and Syl the same, you know. They have been able to address things that weren't addressed in the classic series. Not to in any way take away from the classic series, because there's some stunning, stunning stories there. I mean, it's interesting now that we've got Tennant coming into the Big Finish fold as well, and doing a trilogy of stories with Donna, one of which I'm in, but not as Davros, as a, you know, as the usual kind of character who's got it all wrong. I play a lot of them and get gets killed. I mean, I spend my life working for Big Finish and getting killed.
The nice guy that gets killed in the first episode in the cliffhanger, it's always a shame, that, isn't it?
I know, yeah, absolutely.
You think everything's going to be fine with this character.
Yeah. I mean, well, it happened with me with Big Finish when they did Survivors, you know, the cast was his character. And killed me off after the end of the first series, you know. And every time I see them, I say, God, we made a mistake. God, we made a mistake. Your character is so good. We should have kept the character in. And I'm thinking, well, hey, you know.
That's what all the great series do.
Your choice.
Game of Thrones. Sean Bean took it in the neck.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You have to keep your audience on their toes.
You do, indeed, yeah.
So we're coming to the end of your Doctor Who time on TV, really, with the third Davros story, which is Remembrance of the Daleks. But... Mm-hmm. Not really a Davros story at all, really, is it? It was more a case of that you appeared at the end and it was a cherry on the cake, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was very nearly not in it because I was working on a series for Central called Tales of Sherwood Forest, which has nothing to do with Robin Hood. It was a wine bar in Nottingham called the Sherwood Forest, which Pete Postlethwaite ran, and it was a bit like, it was a very surreal thing that Alan Plater put together. So it was like a kept on throwing back to Casablanca because he basically wanted it to be Riggs Bar, you know, character wanted it to be Riggs Bar in Casablanca. So we were all playing double characters, you know, I was playing one of the Nottingham Crane brothers, basically, one of the Nottingham Underworld, yet also myself and the other two actors, we were playing the Nazis in the you know, the Casablanca version of it. So it was an interesting thing to do. But I was heavily inured in it, and the call came through, can you come and do this? And there were dates, and the director I was working with said, no, can't release you. And I thought, well, that's it, you know. But bless them, both John Nathan Turner and Sarah Bird, who was producing, got their heads together and worked out a kind of lease lend where BBC in the morning and Central in the afternoon, you know, but I could only do one day in the studio because they actually wanted me to be the voice of the battle computer as well.
Of course.
Everyone thought it was Davros. And in fact, I mean, they brought John Leeson in to do it, and it was, you know, it was getting that way, you know, it was that sort of feeling it could be Davros.
But, yes. You know. I certainly fell for it as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Davros, you know, but it wasn't. So, actually, the only scene that involved Davros was that one scene on the bridge in what I call the Texas barbecue. With the flip-top lid, you know, and there's Davros happily frying away on the hot plate.
But he's absolutely barking in Remembrance, isn't he?
Oh, totally.
I will teach you the folly of your words, Doctor! I will destroy you and demonstrate the power of the Daleks!
Davros, I beg of you, don't use the hand.
Doctor, now you begin to fear.
You're making a grave mistake.
Activate the Omega device!
He's gone Freaksville, he really has. Yeah, we're back to the old sort of, how dare you talk to me, you know.
Yes.
He's Hitler in his worst excesses of not listening to anyone and shouting at everybody. And yeah, and I mean, again, it's one of those, you know, I mean, Silver and I had worked together before, long before, in theatre, you know, from way back in the days when he was Campbelling and things like that. So we knew each other, but of course we never actually had a scene together.
Of course, yeah.
It was other side of the studio, I think. It was fascinating that I actually read the audio book of Remembrance of the Daleks of the BBC just recently. And I find that fascinating because there's a whole tranche of stuff that I wasn't aware of from watching the TV that is there in the book.
Yes.
Like the relationship between the Wing Commander and the Chief Scientist. They'd been lovers during the war, you know, and there was all that whole thing. And the fact that the special weapons Dalek was known as the Abomination, you know, by all the other Daleks, because he's the only Dalek that knows what he is. And so he's mad as a bag of rats, even madder than Davros, because he knows who he is. The others don't. They just follow orders. You know, they've been, you know, conditioned to the level. So they all think he's a bit weird. They call him the Abomination because he's not one of them.
It's a terrific piece of writing, that book, actually. I remember reading it when I was about 12 and just blowing my mind because it didn't feel like a young adult's fiction book.
No.
It felt really much more adult, and I think it still stands up. Yeah. I don't remember him getting much into Davros's mind.
Into Davros's mind? Not really, no. It was very similar to as it was in on the telly. They kept Davros hidden, basically, in this pretense of the Emperor Dalek. It's interesting doing that because I found it very easy to myself, and fairly easy to do Sophie. When I came to do me, I thought, fuck that, I do this voice. I get Nick Briggs in again to do everything.
So you've done audios of Davros, you've been on a TV show, you've done readings of the books, you've also played him on stage. You said once and only ever once.
Yeah, never again.
Quite an experience.
It was an immense experience. And I have to say, my life is in your hands, Sam. Because if it were not for the water that you pumped into me regularly, I would have been dead. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Yes, it was an incredibly stressful, yet kind of weirdly uplifting experience at the same time. In retrospect, I'm kind of glad I did it, but again, I still have never again tattooed on my forehead.
I think it's a bit of an ask to have effectively the leading actor in a chair with a mask on his head directing.
Yeah.
Almost impossible. I don't think anybody would do that now.
No. Well, I should have said no. I should have said when they... Yeah, but it was that short notice, you know, when you know, the directors called out one by one. I said, well, we can't do it unless, you know, you direct it, basically. And I suppose in my arrogance, I thought, yes, I can do that. Because I've never done it before, but by changing the script so much as we went along, it meant it harder, made it harder for me to work on and just get under my belt fully. Also, sort of dealing with all the, you know, the fractiousness of you know, the video footage that was or wasn't going to be used in it, and how it's all going to be put together, and then of course the madness on the day of trying to put this thing on with basically no rehearsal at all. Thank God for the professionals around us and the people from Manchester who came in, the lighting and technical guys. It could have been a total disaster. All skill, you know, and all praise to the people who did all the background work. It's yourself and Tony and Dave and Tony and the people who worked so hard in, you know, putting it together. And the people like Peter Miles and John Leeson and Andy Wisher. You know,
absolutely, yes, Andy Wisher, who looks just like his father.
His father, yeah, absolutely. Coming in, you know, to surround it with all that expertise and professionalism that it kind of needed. And great stuff. Oh, and of course, Jeremy Bullock as well.
Of course, it's good. Boba Fett.
Yeah, yeah. Crossover between Star Wars and Star Wars and Doctor Who.
That's an incredible lineup, wasn't it?
It was.
People came together to do that. I think it was all tied together, wasn't it? There was a lot for the fans to enjoy. A lot of crossover, like you say.
A lot of crossover. A lot of in things that were there for them, and the joy of actually having that third new series, Dalek, to come on at the end.
Big deal at the time, I seem to remember.
Totally, yeah. Never been seen before, and the BBC still haven't been able to do what we did on stage. So, all power to everyone in it. Yeah.
So, touching on the new series, you said earlier that you find yourself often replacing other actors, and then that role becomes yours. How does it feel to see Davros depicted in the new series as a viewer and as well as the actor?
As a viewer? Well, I mean, I suppose my parochial love of the character makes me very protective of it. And I didn't see the first one with Tennant when it went out, and everyone kept on texting me and saying, what do you think? And I have no idea. I'm sort of about 300 miles from the North Pole, and I'm looking at polar bears at Svalbard at the moment. So, and I didn't actually see it until probably about 8 months later when I happened to be in a hotel and I saw the episode. And, I mean, Julian Bleach is a superb actor. You know, there's no doubt about it. He's done some great stuff. And I was disappointed in the first one that he did with Tennant because it was kind of like gratuitous. I just didn't like that episode at all. It was the end of the series, and it was a kind of, it smacked of a panto walk down.
Mm.
Oh, look, we've got all the companions back, you know, and we're going to add Davros into the mix as well.
The ending approaches. Exterminate! People and planets and stars will become dust, and the dust will become atoms, and the atoms will become nothing. This is my ultimate victory. The destruction of reality itself. Nothing can stop the detonation. Nothing.
Isn't that good? Isn't that clever? And I just thought, no, it's not.
He's too much of an event, really, himself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can't have that. So when we had him coming back in the new series, you know, in Capaldi's series just recently, I was, again, very worried, you know, but I was delighted with what they did with him. I thought it was just right. You know, I'd love to have played it. I'd love to have done that. And it was a story that I felt was absolutely right, bang on the button, and needed to be done. I'm just so glad that they actually kind of got it right for, you know, for the fans' sake and for, you know, for Julian's sake, because he hooked into the key of what I certainly feel Davros is about. I mean, I'll never play him again on telly. I mean, somebody pointed out I'm far too old.
I thought surely the role is actor proof in terms of age.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. You know, I said I'm actually getting almost close to the point where I begin to look like a character. So, you know, but there we go.
That's a very odd remark.
I've been very happy just to carry on doing the audios because they are my media of choice for working in, and we've had some terrific scripts, you know, and I just trust that there will be more to come, you know, and it's interesting that they stop Big Finish from doing any Davros scripts when they know Davros is coming back into the series, into the TV series. So we haven't had a Davros story since, like, Curse of Davros. Who knows?
But he might be back.
He may be, but, you know, it might not be me. They might suddenly decide to bring Julian Bleach in to do it. I don't know, you know. I took it over from two other very fine actors, and I can't have any gripes or grumbles about handing it on.
But a huge part of your life, Terry. Many years.
Very much part of my life. I know far too much about Davros. I should probably be writing a Davros script, but I'm just so lazy. This is why I went into acting rather than writing or being a musician.
I think many people would consider you to be the Roger Moore of the Davroses, an ambassador for Doctor Who, flying the flag for many years, and very generous to the people who followed him.
Yes, and also with the arched eyebrow, very much so.
I have to ask you another question in regards fans, a mixed bunch.
Oh, Doctor Who fans, yes.
You know, hundreds of thousands of them across the world, different ages, different genders, brings everybody together.
Yeah.
And they're very honest people. What's the rudest thing a fan has ever said to you?
Not rude. I mean, they're unthinking sometimes. It's like, you know, people come up to Colin and say, "You're my fourth favourite Doctor." You know, and you just think, did you think that one through? You know, and people then come up to me and say, "That's really good. You know, I love that and I love that." But my favourite is, of course, you know, Michael Wisher. Nobody's better than him. You know? Okay, fine. Well, good. Fine. So I shall sign this Michael Wisher, shall I? You know? But it's unthinking rather than. I mean, I know fans can get very bitchy from what I hear, and they get very opinionated, and some get very negative about stories, about characters, about directors, about writers, and all of that. I don't play that politics, you know.
No.
I just play enjoyment of a programme that has caused a great deal of enjoyment to a lot of people, and let's celebrate it for that, you know. And in that, I'm really glad to meet up with fans, talk to them about the things that made them hide behind the city, or things that made them really, you know, delighted by watching the programme, or memories of, you know, how they formed relationship with somebody else through Doctor Who, you know, they met as a result of, or they met somebody and converted them to Doctor Who, or whatever it may be, you know, it's to do with family rather than sometimes, it's like being part of a giant extended family.
You are the Roger Moore of Doctor Who, Terry, because Roger Moore doesn't say bad things.
I don't have a voice.
He's never said a bad thing about anybody, Roger Moore, apart from Grace Jones. He's always been very complimentary about the people he's worked with.
Yes.
You mentioned John Nathan Turner, actually, saying that he used to pull some amazing stunts to get people to be in Doctor Who and rearrange schedules. That seems to be what he was actually a genius at. I don't think he's ever given enough credit for logistics.
Very good at that. You know, and he would back his directors if they said this has to happen. I mean, like, you know, Graham wanted John Ogwin to play the Squire, you know, and the BBC bookers apparently were saying, no, you can't, he lives in Wales, it'll cost him a fortune to bring him over, you know, and Graham was arguing his corner, saying, I need this person, he's just absolutely right for this thing, you know, and JNT backed him and said, no, get it.
Tenacious.
Tenacious, yeah, because he thought, no, it's right for the programme, going to make the director happy, and that's going to be a winner. And it did work.
So moving on from Doctor Who, and just to get under the skin of Terry Molloy before we leave.
Uh-huh.
What's your guiltiest pleasure, Terry?
My guiltiest pleasure? I couldn't possibly mention. Well, it's not a guilty pleasure. I have lots of pleasures. I'm not guilty about them. But there are some that are not broadcastable. My guiltiest pleasure, I suppose it's got to be something like bacon butties. I suppose it's that. I mean, somebody said, having to sleep in the afternoon, I find that's great. So I do feel a bit guilty about that. But I just love just lying down, you know. I was talking to somebody about cosplay and said, have you ever considered doing cosplay? I said, you find me a character that basically lies on a beach in a hammock, stark naked, swigging gin and tonics or Bacardi and Cokes. That'll be the one I'll be. Thank you very much. Yes.
And what song would you like played at your funeral?
Probably Jake Thackeray's Last Will and Testament. Have you not heard it?
No.
Listen to it.
Might have to play that at the end of the podcast now, Terry, now that
you've
said
may
that.
Well have to, yeah.
And finally, what's on the horizon for you in 2016?
2016, I've got another inordinate number of trips to the States and a sci-fi cruise. I'm going over to, I'm doing another Regeneration Who in Baltimore in March. Then in April, the Who cruise. I'm also going to Atlanta and New Hampshire later on, and over to Seattle in August to Anglicon there. And I'm doing another one in Wichita as well. So quite a number of events abroad so far. Not many books for the UK, but then they tend to be kind of like almost last minute sometimes for me, you know. Oh, I'm doing Regenerations in Swansea. That's a given.
Oh, that's a good gig. That
absolutely
one.
No. That is a red letter date in my diary. And also, there's some guy up in Newcastle who's doing a thing called Genesis. You know.
Yeah, I hear he's a nice guy.
I believe he's quite a nice guy. Yeah.
And that's in the summertime, isn't it?
That's in June. Yeah, beginning of June. Yes.
In the northeast.
In the northeast,
which is the best part of the country.
I was up there. Not long ago, a few weeks ago, to visit family. And who knows, I might even be back in the Arches at some point, but we never know. And one also looks forward to the possibility of more big finishes and stuff like that. But I take it a day at a time, you know, I have to, you know, you just think, right, okay, we'll go with it day at a time. And it's nice to have time to relax, take the dogs on the beach, not snowing or burning up a sort of a major gale from the Siberian steppes.
Well, winter is coming.
It is, winter is coming, and we've got our logs in, and the log burner is running, and it's lovely and warm, toasty cozy in the cottage at the moment.
That's a lovely way to round off this interview, Terry. Thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you, sir.
Thanks very much.
All the very best.
Astonishing interview, Sam. It's lovely. Yes. Lovely. Wonderful to think that he was available.
Television's yes. Terry Molloy.
Terry Molloy. He did an episode of Bergerac.
I'm sure. I forgot to...
Directed by Graham Harper.
He's in The Archers.
He's Mike Tucker in The Archers, which is confusing because Mike Tucker was also in Doctor Who as a special effects assistant.
Mm. That was Derek Ware.
Derek Ware.
He's dead now.
Dead now, Miss Babs. Yes. Dead Miss Babs. Without further ado, let's press on into the tinsel-coloured time lash.
Ah, the old time lash.
Oh, but it's all arranged.
The Maynard and I have important things to discuss.
Yes, Doctor.
Davros.
Yes.
Davros,
yes,
Tom.
Yes, well, I quite like a bit of Davros, you know, Genesis of the Daleks. Beautiful, beautiful, lovely.
He created the Daleks.
Yeah. It was a great idea, wasn't it, by Tezza Nation to take us back? Because, I mean, yes, we're going to get a bit of a tired old sort of formula. Let's get the Daleks in, defeat them, they bugger off again. You know, what a great story the Genesis of the Daleks was, to bring old Davros into it. What a great idea.
The man in the bath chair.
Was that anything to do with him possibly submitting another runaround story? And I think Bob Holmes read it and said, look, we've had this script 6 or 7 times before. Yeah. Why don't you do something different and take it back?
It's lovely, Terry, but it's Planet of the Daleks.
Is that true?
I believe that's the case, Buddy Windrush.
Don't know.
You're useful. So,
you're sacked.
Don't know, mate.
We're going to talk about Davros, our opinions of the character, really, and the actors who played him. He's always been, I think, one of my favourite villains because he's been quite complex over the years, and he's evolved like the Doctor has. He's changed with each Doctor to some degree. So let's start at the beginning.
Chronologically.
Yeah, okay. So let's go back to 1975.
The rock and roll years.
Michael Wisher.
Yes.
As Davros.
Paper bag on his head.
Yes.
What do we think?
Well, he smelled like a chimney, didn't he? A very fine actor.
Can't go wrong, really. He's wonderful.
He was in all sorts. He was in Carnival of Monsters.
Was he? Wisher?
Michael Wisher.
Yeah. Yeah.
He did several Doctor Who's.
But as Davros, he was pretty good, wasn't he?
Yeah. He had that mask on.
Which was designed by John Friedlander? Is that the correct pronunciation? And
John Highlander.
That was the one. But like, my thing about this is that I got Genesis of the Daleks and
on
DVD recently.
Oh, excellent.
Well, a few years ago. And then Ruth said, oh, I bought you a present. It's another Dalek Doctor Who DVD. It's Destiny of the Daleks. He wasn't in that, what, Davros? No.
No.
But Davros was. Was Davros in that?
Oh, Davros is in it, but it wasn't Michael.
It's not Michael.
No, it's a new Davros, and it's shit.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was my point, that I sort of tried to be excited and thrilled that she'd bought me this DVD. I was like, well, actually, it's not very good.
It's no Genesis.
But just having all the Daleks and Tom Baker doesn't necessarily make it good.
It's scripted by Terry Nation, but script edited by Douglas Adams.
Which are the good bits, but it was a bit dull, really.
There's no respect or reverence paid to the character.
Listen,
he wasn't as good, was he?
It was the same mask, different actor. Didn't really.
But it was
didn't fit very well. Yes, exactly.
Spack off. That's a good bit.
Tell them what I've got here.
He is holding a primed explosive device.
And one false move and it goes right down inside his chair. I'll turn Davros and his life support system into scrap metal. Now spack off!
Well, that's good, yeah.
He spins him round in the chair. There's no reverence for the character, and if there's no respect for the character,
you don't... Right round, Davros, right round.
Like a Dalek baby, right round, right round.
There's no reverence.
He looks a bit like Pete Burns, Davros, doesn't he? If you...
Well, there are people there. Margaret Thatcher being one.
Ina Sharples.
So why didn't they get Wisher back in Destiny?
He wasn't available. And he wasn't available for Resurrection of the Daleks when they moved it, because it was originally at the end of, I think, Davo's second season, is that right?
It was going to be.
Called Warhead, and it was cancelled. And when they remounted it in the third season, Wisher was on a show or something like that. So the director...
Celebrity Squares, I think.
Matthew Robinson picked up Terry Molloy from a show called Radio Phoenix, which I'm sure we've just heard about in the interview, because that hasn't been recorded out of order at all. Radio Phoenix was a kids' TV show where Terry Molloy played a radio DJ. So that's...
Alexei Sale.
So was it a matter of Wisher were here? Or was it more of Molloy to have you?
That doesn't make sense. Was it Molloy in Revelation?
Resurrection. Revelation. Remembrance. Is he the best Davros?
I remember Resurrection of the Daleks when it first went out, and this, in my mind's eye, the way I see it...
Your Davros's eye.
...was that when the big reveal of Davros, it wasn't just like this scream that went up to reveal Davros. As far as I was concerned, it was like the length of a football pitch. Mm. This massive scream that went up, and this figure in blue smoke, and it was Davros. And in my mind's eye, that was a very powerful moment.
Have you seen Genesis of the Daleks? You probably haven't, have you?
No, not at that time. So for me, Terry Molloy was Davros.
James Bond.
Yes, he was James Bond in A View to a Kill. So as far as I was concerned, it was Terry Molloy. Terry Molloy was Davros.
He was it.
And then I saw Revelation. And I was so impressed with Davros in that that I drew a picture of Davros in his little cartoon, in his
fish tank. Oh, yes.
At my grandparents' house.
They must have been thrilled.
Yes.
Oh, Greg, what a lovely picture of Granny. A horrible, monstrous creature. Terry Malloy, that is, Grandma. Yeah.
And then, of course, I remember Remembrance of the Daleks going out, and there was that girl in the chair who did all the sort of,
Angela Lansbury.
All the chanting. And people were saying, oh, it's Davros. And I said, oh, I don't think it is Davros. It wasn't Davros. But then, of course, Davros is revealed at the end.
Yes, there was Davros.
So we were both right.
Yeah.
So Davros was in it, and that was Sylvester McCoy as well.
I mean, Terry Malloy was fine. He was absolutely fine. But I just still, you can't beat Wisher. Maybe it's better written. Maybe it's because it was. I mean, you can't go wrong, can you?
But don't you think that? Sorry.
Here we go.
Is it because Wisher was the first in saying that? Because I think Malloy was better. He's more versatile than Wisher. Because if you look at Resurrection, for example, I can't imagine Wisher doing those lines. And it's quite well written, really. I'm a bit of an Eric supporter, as you know. I don't think that Wisher could have done the same with those scripts that Malloy did.
It certainly would have been different.
And Revelation as well.
So Malloy brought a more emotional content, do you think?
There was more dynamics to it. There was more light and shade. I think Wisher was far more one-note. That's my view.
Played it more as a Nazi.
Yes, I think so.
That's what he was. Yeah. He was Mengele, wasn't he?
Yes, I think
yes, he was.
The Malloy Davros is played more like a senile person than a Nazi. By the end, in Remembrance of the Daleks, he is just a raving loon.
I think it's fine. I think it's great, but I think it's just better written, isn't it? It's a character in Genesis of the Daleks. It's not a sort of an enemy, a sort of an arch enemy of the Doctor's. It becomes a rather sort of, I mean, especially in the new series, it's like, oh, the evil arch enemy of the Doctor. In Genesis of the Daleks, he's just a horrible man who creates the Daleks. He was a bit wizened,
Michael Wisher was the George Lazenby of Davros. He only had one shot at it.
Yeah.
Whereas Terry Malloy's performance...
Roger Moore-ish.
I think Terry Malloy based his performance of Davros on Anthony Perkins in the Psycho movies, because he's sort of fairly rational to begin with. And then he just gets more and more insane and
just the loopiness then at the end. All that sort of stuff. Yeah. Not exactly subtle, is it?
F-O-C, that's... free of charge. That's Davros. That's
my favourite Davros line. Yeah.
I mean, we reviewed Revelation in the last season, didn't we?
We did.
We kind of marked that as being one of the standout performances of that show.
Oh, it's biblical.
It's an excellent performance, and Malloy Gibbs he's basically got nothing to work with apart from a mask in a cage, which is incredible, and it's a transfixing performance.
You take him off very well with certain lines, like he's very distinctive, aren't they?
It's very articulate.
Like the line you were saying.
Oh, Dalek tissue. It's a little bit. It's a bit sing-songgy.
Yes.
I don't know what he based it on.
The Kleenex he did, was it?
what about concentrated protein?
Yes. And there was another one with the receipt.
The receipt.
Checking the receipt. Where you were with Terry Malloy and he was checking.
Oh gosh, yes. Checking a receipt. I was very lucky a couple of years ago to have a Chinese meal with Terry Malloy after he'd been in a show. I think it was called Strangers on a Train. Yes, it was.
Chinese restaurant.
Yes, it was set in a train. And we had a lovely Chinese meal, and the bill came, and I looked down at it and I looked at Terry and I said, this isn't right. It's like, this cannot be correct. And he looked at me with a glint in his eye. It's like, yes, all right. Let's move on and not talk about Doctor Who. he's very affable guy, very friendly and very good with the fans and everything.
So would you rank him above Wisher then?
I'd rank him above Goodison without a blink.
Goodison Park was dreadful.
Yes, Goodison. Everton play their football.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the performance as such, it was the dialogue and what he was given to do, so he didn't have much to do in terms of making Davros sinister or interesting.
No, he was just phoning it in, really, wasn't he, old Goodison? And he's dead now, isn't he? So we can say that.
He's still alive.
Oh, still alive.
I didn't mean
are there more than three Davri in the original Doctor Who? Is it just the three?
Just the three?
Just the three.
And there's just been the one in the new series, which is Julian
Glover. Yeah,
Bleach.
Julian Bleach, who now has eyes.
Well, yes, let's not talk about that. But,
well, that's modern surgery for you.
It's modern. He's got a laser eye treatment, doesn't he, old Davros? So I think, I'm always a stickler.
They're
for the
equals
original,
for me.
I
mean, they're equals for me.
Are they?
Yeah, no, I think Revelation.
Terry.
Revelation of the Daleks is a really good story, and I really like Davros in it. It's a Davros story as well. It's not really a Dalek story. And Genesis of the Daleks equally is not a Dalek story. It's a Davros story. And they're both central to the plot.
Well, with Genesis, you've also got Peter Miles playing Nida, who probably has a... he's the
good
sort of
Nida.
Yeah, good.
That's one
he's
of his catchphrases.
His right-hand man, isn't he? He's sort of the Goebbels of...
I mean, talking about the actors who played Davros is slightly, you know, odd, but it's more like, as a character, Davros. I mean, I prefer it in the early days, but it was just... this idea that he's the arch-enemy of the Doctor, it doesn't really wash with me.
It's got a bit comic strip now, hasn't
it? It's all a bit like, oh, well, you know, they're not really sort of opposites in any way. He's just a horrible, horrible creature.
I think the problem with any recurring villain, not a species, the Daleks are fine because you can kill them off and then you can bring the species back. Yeah. With a recurring villain, you know that they're going to drift off and the Doctor's going to drift off and the game is going to be played again in a few years' time.
Yeah.
And Davros has become that as a
just
master.
Like, wheel him out, you know.
And it's literally... You run out of ideas when you do that. That's the problem. Going back to Nida, very interesting. Do we have a reading that Nida and Davros might have something going on in section 28?
They have an inalienable right to be gay.
Over to you, Greg.
But was there a relationship between Davros and Nida, do you think?
No.
Is there a subtext there?
Well, there's that line from Remembrance where McCoy says, "Don't use the hand, Davros." So it's a possibility.
Well, that's a closed book.
It could be.
But let's open another one in Josiah's library
with...
Oh, me. Sorry.
No, you two run along. I'm going to do a spot of reading. Tell me to finish this book before we reach Bombay.
In Josiah's library today is it's not a Target book. It's quite interesting. It's a Pinnacle fiction book. It's called Doctor Who and the Genesis of the Daleks by Terence Dicks. Now, I don't think I need to talk too much about the plot of this book, but let me tell you, it arrived this week in a brown paper package.
Ooh.
Samuel Payne, as some regulars will know, is the fount of all knowledge in Doctor Who and also has every Doctor Who thing going. So when I say, oh, I've got to review a book or I've got to watch The Curse of Fenric, he'll send me something in the post, a DVD or a book, and I was surprised, I was stunned to find that this Doctor Who book had arrived, but not in a bubble wrap thing from Paradise Towers where Sam lives. It was from Amazon, I think, or World of Books or something. I was like, hey, this is a queer thing. If I ordered a book and forgot about it. I ripped it open with much aplomb, apologising to my wife, saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have ordered another book, I know we're busy. And opened it up, and there it was, Doctor Who and the Genesis of the Daleks. He'd actually ordered it, my own singular copy, and I thought, my God, Sam, you're really pushing the boat out, you're really breaking the bank by ordering me my own copy of Genesis of the Dark. I must say to listeners out there, I have actually read this as a youth, but I gave all my Doctor Who paraphernalia away to Matthew Bellwood, in a sort of fit of pique. But what's wonderful about this, and I understand the reason why you've sent me this, Sam, because it is quite a wonderful artefact. What it is, it's the American version of Doctor Who and the Genesis of the Daleks, and so it's got a rather strange version of the logo that I've never seen before, and it's got yellowed pages, and on the back it says Daleks, Daleks, Daleks. And it's basically what it's trying to do is it says at #4, #4, it was before Twitter, to introduce the American audience to Doctor Who. And it's got what I can only describe as a wonderful introduction by a chap called Harlan Ellison.
Oh yes.
May I read some of it?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to read it in an English accent because my American accent is pretty poor. They could not have been more offended, confused, enraged, startled. There was a moment of stunned silence, then an eruption of angry voices from all over the 1,500-person audience. The kids in their Luke Skywalker pyjamas cobbled up from older brother's cast-off karate G. I don't know what that means. And the retarded adults, spot welded into their Darth Vader fight mask, howled with fury. But I stood my ground there on the lecture platform at the World Science Fiction Convention, and I repeated the heretical words that had turned them into animal hysterics. Star Wars is adolescent nonsense. Close Encounters is obscure puritanist drivel. Star Trek can turn your brains to puree of bat guano. And the greatest science fiction series of all time is Doctor Who!
Doctor Who?
What a wonderful start to an introduction, and what a very strange sort of thing, artifact this book is, because it's this guy called Harlan Ellison is a TV writer, and he's trying to get the kids of America, as Kim Wilde so memorably sang about, into Doctor Who, and he does so by dissing Star Wars, which immediately I warmed to him. Yeah, when they re-released Star Wars in the cinemas.
With 90s special effects.
Yes, that was it. And some of my friends said, let's go and see them. I didn't see Star Wars, but they said, let's go and see The Empire Strikes Back. Why is he held to be the best one? So I thought, I'll go. I'm going to bone up on Star Wars. So I went to see I got Star Wars on VHS and watched it one afternoon, and I was appalled by how awful it was. Mm. And I didn't go and see The Empire Strikes Back. I'm a bully to you. I'm not going to bother with that. Badly directed, badly performed, badly conceived, poor plotting. What a pile of shit.
Diminishing returns as well.
Rubbish.
I mean, the first two are reasonable, and then it's just utter shit after that. I still maintain that when they brought the franchise back with The Phantom Menace, probably the worst film I've ever seen on the big screen.
I was stoned out of my head. Mm. I'd had several bongs.
Even Brian Blessed in it, shouting, "Vroom!" Nick couldn't make it for me.
It doesn't cut it for me, so I'll polish it. So it's very good to see that this guy Harlan is so disparaging of Star Wars.
Did we look him up? Is
no, I didn't. He's a television writer. I doubt he'd be still alive, but who knows? Sam, do you know?
It doesn't ring a bell for me, but I know the introduction is quite famous because there's lots of edits to these books for the American market. One being that they changed Jelly Babies to Jelly Beans.
I noticed the Jelly Beans, but I didn't notice a huge amount of others because I read it very quickly. But just another quote here that really sums up a lot of what we talk about in Doctor Who. And so he talks about the fact that he reads everything, and he describes Doctor Who as elegant trash, which I think is a really, really good description. So he compares them to Edgar Rice Burroughs novels, The Shadow, Doc Savage, Conan, comic books, and Uncle Wiggily. They taught me a great deal of what I know about courage and truth and ethic in the world. To that list I add Doctor Who. His adventures are sunk to the hips in humanism, decency, solid adventure, and simple good reading. They're not classics, make no mistake. They can never touch the illuminative level of Dickens or Mark Twain or Kafka, but they are solid entertainment based on an understanding of good and evil in the world. What a wonderful description of Doctor Who.
It's everything you want in Doctor Who as well, isn't it? It's a good story.
I got terribly excited when I read that, and I just thought, what a great gift. Thanks, Sam. So I'm not really talking about the book, I'm more talking about the introduction, but I would get your hands on it. How much did it cost?
About £2.
£2 of your English money and your...
Do they change the spellings of words like colour and flavour?
They do, yes, which is a little bit distracting, but I mean, I'm not going to talk hugely about the plot, because we all know the plot, James of the Daleks, but what I will say is that like a lot of those adventure stories that this chap Harlan is talking about, it's pretty raw stuff, isn't it, Genesis of the Daleks? I mean, I've watched it recently. So I don't watch it for this, I don't know, but it's a very adult story, and there's a description of Sarah waking up under a lot of corpses, and somehow when you read that, it's far more visceral and far more unpleasant than it is to see it. To see it, it's like it's a bit shonky, and the special effects aren't great, and they clearly aren't dead because they're sort of out-of-work actors, aren't they? Dressed up as stars or whatever they are. But reading that, it's horrifying. Yeah. And you think, what a thing to happen to a companion, to be under a, presumed dead and under a pile of corpses. I think when you're a kid, you read that and it's like, oh, great, I love that, sort of lots of gore and body horror. But I think when you're sort of a bit older, it's a bit horrifying. So
Happened to John Pertwee in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Did it?
He woke up in a morgue.
Bloody hell.
On the ship, the ship had been torpedoed. He was assumed dead. He'd only been knocked unconscious when he woke up under a pile of bodies covered in blood.
That's unpleasant.
I think Genesis of the Daleks is probably the closest Dalek story. It's definitely the closest Terry Nation story to Second World War concerns.
Well, yeah.
Because it's got all of the Auschwitz overtones, as well as nuclear warfare.
That's exactly what I thought of when I was reading it, just thinking, for kids this is fine, but for adults it's terrible, because for kids they don't know about all this sort of stuff. They're sort of not wise to it all, and war is just war. It's a sort of a Biggles hero heroics and the Doctor. And there's a part where the Doctor's being shot at, and I was reading it last night in bed, I was thinking, God, that would be really awful if someone shot you. You'd be dead. And then we'd have PTSD. And it'd be, so I'm injecting this sort of adult realism into the book, and I guess taking it seriously as it, but because it's written so well. I mean, it's Terence Dix, isn't it? So he's taken the scripts that Terry Nation wrote, pretty much written the dialogue down and put it into put it into words with the descriptions. But that's, I mean, he's so good, isn't he, Terence Dix?
Oh, yes.
He really is, and he's a modern master, even though he's very old.
He's very good at economy.
Yeah, he just sort of been able to describe things in a very simple way. We say this every time about Terence Dix.
But we can't overstate that point, I think. And it kind of touches on what we were talking about in the previous episode about Fenric. It's a very rich, in a way immature piece of writing.
Yeah.
Whereas I find the best writers are the ones that can use the minimum number of words with the finest economy to get the point across in the quickest way.
And a simple
That's
story.
The skill
a
of
simple,
a writer.
Clear story.
Yeah.
You know exactly what's going on.
There's no confusion in Genesis of the Daleks about what is going on, yet you're still hooked with all the symbolism and all the imagery and everything else that goes with it, and the backstory and the history which is associated with that kind of writing. And that's the way to do it. Fenric is great, but the wrong way to
make
that point.
You know, it's a good choice to sort of launch this as an American series. You know, let's get. I don't know what else they chose. It doesn't actually detail what other books.
The Doomsday Weapon was one of them.
I'm not sure about that one. Yeah, I just think it's very interesting that sort of American version and a great introduction to the series. The Doctor is so good, so human, and obviously the "Have I the Right" bit is great. But you know, even all the way through, and he did. I remember talking about the Loch Ness Monster. It compensates for what could be seen as poor writing on Terry Nation's part. So you always know what the Doctor's thinking.
Right.
And it's like, yes, the Doctor was disappointed or sad or, you know, upset that the thing that was happening. It may not have seen it on screen. It may not be written into the character, but Terence Dix gives you that because it makes him the Doctor human. I know the Doctor isn't human, but he is the most human character in the show in many ways. Anyway, so it's a wonderful thing. So thank you for giving me some joy with Harlan Ellison.
I've got a question.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes.
Who is Uncle Wiggily?
Well, I think it's an American thing. Yes. Uncle Wiggily, you're referring to.
Wiggily, sorry.
Yes, no, I have no idea, but that's the joy of reading American things. Doesn't make any sense, but yes. Another thing is that what Terence Dix does really well is introduce each character as if you've never seen them before. Mm-hmm. We get very used to the fact that we know all these characters, but he'll just have one line and you'll get it, you know, with the description of Harry or Sarah Jane or the Doctor.
Tom, could you find the point in the book where he introduces Davros? Because I have a memory of reading that 20 years ago.
Maybe the wrong bit. I'll read it anyway. There was another man in the room, but Sarah was unable to see him clearly. He was on the near side of the pool of light, his back to her, and was almost hidden from shadows, hidden by shadows. All Sarah could see was the back of an elaborate wheelchair. A withered right hand hovered constantly over the controls built into the chair arm. The man finished setting up the target. "I am ready, Davros." He walked over to the stand by the man in the chair, his back to Sarah. "Observe the test closely, Garmin, my friend. This will be a moment to live in history." The voice, unlike mine, was almost inhuman. Filtered through some mechanical reproduction system, it had a harsh, grating quality that Sarah found familiar. She saw a claw-like hand touch a switch. There was a whirring sound from the outer darkness, and something moved into the pool of light. Is this bit? Is this the bit? Okay, so let's do the soundtrack now. Okay, so I'll start again with "there was a whirring sound." Is it not this bit? It's not this bit! Oh, listeners, I'm so sorry. It was a gleaming metal creature with a rounded base. The body was constructed of heavily studded metal panels. The top was a dome from which is it the Daleks introduction? Yes. Anyway, blah blah blah. Yes, that's it.
Well done.
Pretty much.
Beautiful.
Very
beautiful.
Very excellent, said Davros. "Locomotion is still faulty, and we must improve his sense organs, but the weaponry is perfect. We can begin." I think it's a good.
That's Garmin played by.
Dennis Chinnery.
Who was also in a much better story called The Twin Dilemma, featuring Colin Baker.
That's my number one.
He's dead now, Miss Bounce.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
That's right, it was a pleasure. 4 out of 5.
Thank you.
See you in a bit.
Bye bye, my dears.
She
I didn't think he'd ever
meet. Here we go. Nothing. He was only meant to record 5 minutes, and he stayed for the whole thing, sitting there like the collector, rubbing his hands, getting facts right.
And he was just tutting.
What a tutting,
like a woman.
Shaking his head every time we know something.
Fucking what an inhibitor.
He actually thinks that people like Matt Smith are good as Doctor Who. What?
It's just a sacrilege, really, but, you know, we have to put up with these people, but not in the house. So I think we just need to send apologies to the listeners out there. So, you know, you got through it. Like us, we were all holding our breaths, but he did leave in the end. So there's a sense in which it was worth it just for the joy of getting rid of him.
Yeah, so thanks for sticking with us. It won't happen again.
And please don't write in saying you want to appear, because we fucking won't have you. You're listeners, for God's sake. You're not contributors. We're not on the BBC.
No.
We're not
a charity.
No. Don't text in your opinions. We don't want to know them.
And if we get things wrong or mispronounce names, it's because we're stupid.
We've heard that people have stopped following us because we get things wrong. Yes. The important thing is we have other things going on in our lives.
Yes, Dostoevsky.
We're only human.
Doctor Who isn't that important to us. We enjoy talking about it.
We do. So
if you take offence to us getting things wrong, or if you don't find us funny, you can basically f*** off.
Yes, f*** off, listeners.
Yeah.
Along with Buddy with
f*** everyone up.
F*** off.
Really, as long as you're the bit. F*** off.
F*** off.
Yeah, I got f*** off.
Bye. If you enjoyed listening to that twaddle, you can follow us on Twitter at DW Menagerie. That's at DW Menagerie, and we'll be tweeting various photographs of our inside leg measurements and that sort of thing.
Doctor Who is copyright of the BBC. No infringements on copyright are intended. Support Doctor Who by purchasing DVDs and CDs and all other media from the BBC. Any comments made by the complete menagerie, almost, are all our own.
You've been listening to a Sixth Floor production.